Let's be honest here. I think we're as surprised as you are for this one. Tom York, Stanley Donwood live in conversation with Evan Preco and myself, Doug Gillen, from XL Recordings in West London. Welcome to Radio Juxtapose. The cross-cultural intersection between music and visual art is a playground of creative exploration. I couldn't think of two individuals more qualified to discuss this than the guests on today's episode. As the lead singer of the band Radiohead, Tom York has spent almost four decades at the forefront of the contemporary music zeitgeist, whether he likes that or not. Through 9 studio albums with Radiohead, 3 solo albums, side projects through bands Atoms for Peace and the more recent outfit The Smile, countless production features and collaborations, Thomas Edward York is one of the most innovative and forward-thinking names in music. Full stop. The centre of Radiohead's visual identity is the Essex-born Brighton-based artist known as Stanley Donwood. Since the release of the 1994 EP My Iron Lung, Donwood has taken Radiohead through abstracted and arid landscapes, moon-shaped pools and haunted woods, lying at the foundation of the band itself. The pair met on the first day studying art at the University of Exeter. When describing the encounter, Tom has previously said, "I figured I'd either end up really not liking this person at all, or working with them for the rest of my life." Fortunately for us all, it was the latter. As a creative partnership, they've continued to break the mould of what it means to package an album, from hidden secrets stashed in CD cases, to handing out newspapers in East London and creating a big tech company that would supposedly record your own dreams. We're joined today by the pair in XL Recordings tucked off Portobello Road in West London. A particularly easy building to find because down the side of it is a mural depicting Stanley's artwork for Tom's 2006 solo album, The Eraser. Celebrating 2 decades since the release of the groundbreaking 4th album Kid A and its follow-up Amnesiac, Radiohead marked the occasion with a double album re-release titled Kid Amnesia, complete with a host of previously unreleased material. Alongside this, Stanley and Tom exhibited a series of hand-painted canvases and sketches in London's auction powerhouse Christie's for a show titled How to Disappear Completely. To understand the significance of Kid A, it's important to understand the context surrounding it. The international success of their 3rd album, OK Computer, paired with relentless touring topped off with headlining one of the most mythologized Glastonbury performances ever, took this band into a new dimension. The scale of this pressure took them individually to the brink of collapse. That's not me. Inspired by Warp Records acts like Aphex Twin and Otekra, Kid A and Amnesiac set fire to the guitar-driven riffs the band were previously known for. Though now celebrated as one of the greatest albums of all time, Kid A was met with mixed reviews when it was released. Earning 2 stars from The Guardian, the fan base was well and truly split down the middle. Now we join Tom York and Stanley Donwood 20 years after this period to talk about the album that rebuilt Radiohead. This is Radio Juxtapose.
I called Essex shit by mistake yesterday. It went down on tape.
In an interview?
The whole, yeah, I cut a whole county.
You're from Essex. I think you've got a little leeway. If you're not from Essex, suppose, then you call it shit.
It's not like saying kind of, if you said it about somewhere else.
That reminds me of a time we played some big festival in Scotland. It was pissing down with rain and everyone looked really miserable. So I thought, you guys should move down south.
Oh, yeah, right.
That didn't go.
Where was that? Glasgow.
They didn't see the funny side. It was like, there was a crowd just went, ooh.
The rest of the band's looking at you like, man.
Ed was like, you wanker.
We're revisiting something from the past. Most obvious place to start with this is why.
Good point.
Yeah.
It felt like someone turned an electromagnetic, a high strength electromagnetic magnet on a while back,
Yeah, two and a half years ago.
Yeah, and that was like sort of the V&A, actually. They came to us.
Because we'd done a OK Computer 20 years on. Let's put it out again. Because basically, we've always made a lot more work than we needed to package a record. And there's been a lot of kind of, not really ephemera, but a kind of world created around what we do for each project, as I call them. And we don't use it because there's, you know, especially with a record company, you can have, you know, 24 pages in a CD booklet, and there's, you know, a limited number of surfaces on a vinyl package. So we have so much more. So we did everything with OK Computer quite extensively. We went through notebooks and sketchbooks. I was kind of like, I didn't want to do the next record because it was a really hard time for everyone. I didn't know how healthy it would be to revisit that.
Mm.
But then the V&A
came and said they wanted to do a whole retrospective.
So instead of like a repackaging, a re-release of the record, we could like, ah?
When they came back and said they wanted to do a retrospective of everything, of all the stuff we'd done. Yeah. And I thought that was really naff.
Why?
I don't know.
Did you see the Pink Floyd show?
Oh, that's an Essex moment right there. Right?
That was a very clear representation of a way that could be done. Essex is a fine county and full of upstanding people.
I'm so happy it was you, not us, that did that. Thank you.
Do you think that it comes down to the fact that there was just too much volume of information and ephemera, as you would say?
No, it's more like I'd had a bee in my bonnet about it, like ever since we'd finished those records. I guess maybe it was a personal thing for me. Like, that was the first time where I'd started to really enjoy being involved in the artwork side of it. And it was like a way out of the weight creatively being put on the music. And it was a way of to have another creative outlet with Mr. Donewood in the shed, you know, on the computer, because when we did OK Computer, it was like, do something. Let's do this. And it was all done with a scanner and blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly we had this huge big space, you know, and it was like this sense of release and excitement.
And time as well, because the success of OK Computer had made the record company relatively relaxed on how much time we could have and how much freedom we could have with the packaging for the record. I don't think they quite anticipated how far I was going to take that.
There was no deadline, no nothing. And we sort of just hit upon a few different things as it was going. We didn't think about it. Much like actually the way we did the music, there was a lot of scratching around. And then it was like preparatory work, and then things started gelling in an extreme. Anyway, the V&A came to us with this idea, and I went back and said, would you consider something around Kid A and Amnesiac instead? Because that's something we'd always wanted to do, and we had access to the multitrack, so we could split them out. Nigel, there was a lot of unused bits of sound. Started from there. So the magnet got switched on there.
Yeah.
Everything started getting pulled towards.
And Tom drew this picture, like they sent a drawing of this, of the outside of the V&A, and there's a courtyard there, and Tom drew this picture of just this mad stack.
Like topper block.
Yeah, you know, with Jenga, but like with shipping container size.
And bright it would be this bright red
blocky thing in the neoclassical courtyard of the V&A, and I was just like, that would be amazing. Well, that's like sticking it to the man, isn't it? Putting that in the middle of that part of London.
Strangely enough, there was something there was something underneath which meant if we put that there, it would have fallen through. And
they covered it with tiling. Each tile was worth like £1,000 or something.
That wasn't
and right. The whole courtyard was paid for by the fucking Sacklers. So, you know, and this was just, and all that stuff was just about to happen.
Is that number two?
Oh, shit. No, I think they're bad, aren't they?
No,
officially
you can,
bad.
You can go with that.
They're responsible for the opioid crisis. Yeah, so. Yeah, so that was not been a, the optics weren't particularly good.
And then the pandemic happened, so the magnet's still going, and we're still collating everything while that's happening.
Because we had to start developing this, like, with using 3D software anyway.
Yeah, that's right. And we were sort of collecting this stuff up, and our friend Christine, who also does, she's an amazing set designer, we asked her to help us with it. there was this shocking kind of like, we were finding all this stuff and it was kind of alarming how much there was. We thought there would be quite a lot, but it was nuts.
But when you guys start, you're going to, okay, we're going to revisit the artwork for this. Where is all of this?
We, it was a lot of obscure.
Slightly embarrassing.
Drawing. What?
Oh, you know, well, I kept like large paintings in a kind of terrible storage unit that was totally unsecure and locked with a combination padlock. Laughable. But because I just moved, you know, I had to arrange everything really quickly. And so it was a lot of happenstance.
My office found all my notebooks. I'd lost them, but they'd taken them and protected them without me knowing. It was a bit like that.
So they were just kind of scattered.
Same with the sound files. That was tricky. We found 95% of it in the end, but it's been quite a struggle. And we found all this video stuff that we'd forgotten existed.
Were these your blips?
No, those we knew we had. Oh, although we did find some that we rejected for good reason, actually. Yes. That all happened, and then the pandemic hit. We were just about to drop it completely. And then I was sitting there on a downer about it. And then I thought, hang on a minute, we've been modeling all this stuff with our friend Sean, who's like a video artist and filmmaker. And we thought, well, you know, all my friends like in the fashion industry were talking about moving into doing virtual versions of, and it started making me think, well, we should do the same, you know.
This was such a pivotal moment for you as a collective, and I know particularly for yourself, Tom, as well. How does it feel revisiting this? You know, is enough time passed that it feels you're not quite as in it as you once were?
We both had the same problem, that it was just quite alarming discovering our state of mind, rediscovering our state of mind, barely recognizing the people involved. But, you know, the magnetic pull now is like, it's a drag now, because it's like, now it's just question. It's got that thing where there's loads of big releases, so it gets really messy. But there was this sort of interim period where we were developing the idea of the exhibition and we were rediscovering all the work. And it was a bit of a gift, really, because I don't think we really noticed what we were doing first time, because it was one of those times, which doesn't always happen, I think, when you look back retrospectively and you understand a little of the context of it was pre-millennium. There was the war in Kosovo and where we were at, and you see the work again and it feels sort of, it feels more significant now than it did then to me, weirdly.
And then you're adding new elements to the work that
we didn't.
No, there's
no new work.
No
that
new
was like
work.
A mantra. No new
right
work.
Right at the beginning, like,
and we couldn't adapt anything. We couldn't make anything better.
Was there anything you wanted to adapt or change?
No, actually, because it was at that time, I think there was everyone was, for one reason or another, not in a particularly good place. Mentally, emotionally, and which is sort of why I didn't want to revisit it early on. But it's quite, all of the stuff that was going on politically, culturally, was we were kind of like eating this stuff up and then spitting it out and as new work back then,
like your poem, that nothing poem, where you literally he'd taken a political speech
about nuclear weapons
and replaced were anything to do with nuclear with nothing.
Yeah.
And it just read like a Tony Blair speech.
It's really, really weird.
Very
it
odd.
Sounds like it sounded like it was full of lots of important things, but actually meant absolutely zero. Yeah.
Anyway.
So we had all this material that we made on as sort of slightly deranged people. So when we looked back at it, it was from the perspective of 2019, 2020. It was like, it was okay. I don't want to be that person anymore. But it's quite impressive what we did when we were those
people.
The
funny thing was, there was this sort of confidence in like the multi-directional madness of like, we were absolutely, totally confident that this would all form together into something that made sense. It at no point did we ever stand there and go, what the living fuck is this supposed to be?
Yeah.
We just did stuff. And it was same musically. It's like, there was a very long period where we're like, we're just going to do stuff. We're not going to worry about it. After we'd gone through the initial pains of starting, And there's all these different narratives, these different characters, these different ideas, this idea of landscape, this idea of a minotaur. It wasn't like we ever sat down and say, we're going to pursue the concept of landscape. You know, it just happened.
You guys obviously have known each other since art school. Did it feel a little bit like that kind of confidence where it's like, I don't know any better, so we're just going to make as much stuff as possible? And there's sort of, you know, art school kids now have an expectation they're going to have exhibitions and they're going to be take over the world. But back in late 80s,
no, we had an expectation we were going to have to get a shitty job or right. go on the dole. Yeah. It was that
most
was
of our
it.
Friends, you know, when we left art school, everyone was really, really struggling. That you know, the first thing you tell you art school is like, yeah, you're not going to get a job out of this.
So they really get you into it.
Like most arts courses now. We had this weird thing, we were talking about this yesterday. I think we hid behind the fact that it was cover art for a record, so it's not really art.
It's commercial. So
we don't have to take ourselves seriously. And we spent an awful lot of time and energy making very, very sure that everything we possibly did, we also tore to pieces artistically within whatever we were writing. Everything was had this sort of self-annihilating quality to it, just to make sure that there was no mistake that anyone could possibly assume that we believed anything in anything we possibly did.
Has that dynamic changed since then?
I think we're sort of...
We've got these paintings of Christie's, maybe.
I mean, I think, because at the time I was really anti the term graphic design, and because graphic design used to be known as commercial art, and I much preferred that because that encompasses all art. All art is commercial because all art is, you know, apart from possibly religious iconography, which is made for the glory of whichever deity it's aimed at. All art is commercial, so I wanted to sort of extend that out and sort of prove that all the stuff in the fancy galleries and everywhere, it's all commercial art. It's all the same.
We did fall out of art college, and the thing we absolutely agreed about was that. I mean, we didn't know that we'd end up working together when we left art college.
No.
But we did spend an awful lot of time ranting about it when we were at college.
How did that then come back in? Because it came in quite quick.
I mean, I'd signed to EMI Records like within 4 months of leaving college, and then was spinning out going, you know, because they had their way of doing the packaging, which was like, do you like this? Okay, good. That's it.
Wow.
No annihilation, no tearing to shreds, none of that process.
And I would try to have a conversation with a very well-meaning chap about like trying to develop. And I was like, well, I'm either going to have to do this myself and I don't have enough confidence to do that, or I'm going to have to call him because I can't handle this sort of, I'm too much of an artist to just let someone do this, but I'm not enough of an artist to believe I can do it on my own, and I'm busy anyway. And I knew he had the right sort of sense for it.
Possibly that was all because we didn't know the difference between RGB and CMYK. And like, you just bought a copy of Photoshop, and we were like, yeah, but I know
this is the thing. This is the funny thing about it was there was a kind of brass neck shit about it as well, because I said to EMI, give me like $4,000. I'm going to do it with a mate. And they're like, okay.
Did you go, don't worry, I went to art school? Did you
throw on it? I'm a fucking professional, you know. I'm fully trained. I got a 2-1. And I went into this Mac store, bought all this stuff, spent 3 weeks trying to make it work, gave up on the printer completely, but managed to figure out Photoshop. And then we were off, really.
Yeah, but we did use all of the filters in Photoshop. So we spent about a month making just a whole portfolio of excruciating Photoshop artwork. It was truly nasty.
It was hilarious.
But then we figured out like a way of doing it, which was we'd sort of film with VHS stuff and then run it through Tom's VHS player and telly, take photos of the TV screen with a film camera, go and get the film developed in town, get the photos back, scan the photos, colorize them in Photoshop, and that became the artwork. And that really was the beginning of, like, computer is just a pencil with ideas above its station. It's very difficult to make art that feels like it's got any soul just on a computer.
What was it then that made you want to use this digital component? You know, why weren't you just painting in a more traditional manner?
That's a good question. I mean, I left art school working on computers, and he did printmaking. Yeah. And it did not even vaguely occur to us that we'd actually make real marks for a while. And even when the most, you know, one of the most exciting things when we bought a scanner and a Wacom tablet to do this, like, you know, it was like two children who'd just been shown how technology worked when we did, like, a computer. And then we're like, wait a minute, we're art students.
Super early days of the internet as well. The internet was just like, it was at the time, it was a blank sketchbook and you could draw whatever you wanted on it. And it was, you know, it had a lot of limitations, but also a lot of possibilities.
Yeah, there was definitely, you know, that openness in those early days of the internet, where the internet didn't exist through the gatekeepers that it exists through now, where we go on and we go to the dedicated channels. It was open and it was blogs and it was experimental.
It wasn't like Facebook till 2005 or something. You know,
but it still had to be an album cover.
There was an element of, like, composition and like, we had to put some text on it, shit, like that. And there had to be an image of some description.
What you did, the bends, you could kind of be like, okay, well, we're going to do OK Computer now. And the record label's like, okay. Or are they still kind of like, what are you guys doing?
They were okay with OK Computer.
There were some excellent meetings that we had with our...
About font size.
No, there was excellent. Well, every time we, like... It's funny now, because we were the opposite. But at the time, we were like, we just want... we'd always go in with the design and have no text on it at all. Yeah. And we'd both be sitting there going, really? Come on, everybody knows it's us. We don't need to put what's on it. Yeah. On it.
Is that because it changed the meaning?
No, because we didn't know what the fuck we were doing.
Yeah, it's not that deep.
It was just, oh, do we have to put text on it? It's really nice without.
Yes, but yeah. I'm still trying to do that with book covers and stuff. Be great. People will pick it up more if it doesn't say anything. They want to know what it is.
We had lots of different... We'd throw them all these things. And it was... We were pretty lucky. They would, if they possibly could, they would go with it. And by the time we came to do Kid A and Amnesia, they fully had given up trying to say anything, you know. And the blips really came from them tentatively saying... we'd like to do some TV adverts promoting the album. And we said, normally we have a picture of the cover and we play some music.
And we tell people, like, in writing.
So I was like, no. Yeah.
Are you guys going to have a music video? No. Blips.
Yes. I was impressed that they went with that.
The little hidden booklet behind Kid A was, kind of faffing around with a case, and I was like, there's a little gap here.
Can we put something in
Yeah.
What was this dynamic then while you were creating the artwork for Kid A? Because you were together, weren't you?
We spent a lot of time in the studio, a lot of time.
Well, the band had, you had a studio.
Even before that, we went to Copenhagen and Paris, and they were both like sort of car crashes. Well, things did come out of them, but it was really, really... It was entirely my fault, because I basically said I didn't think we should rehearse anything. So there we were, like, everybody going, so what are we doing? But
it'll just come
far too long. And me sitting behind a bong going, look, it's really obvious, fuck's sake.
You know, both of those, when we were in Paris, when we saw this incredible David Hockney show at the Pompidou, which was like
totally blew our mind.
Big influence on what we then went to do. And then in Copenhagen, there's an amazing museum in the middle of this park that had all these trees with little fingers on them. that became, you know,
Three Fingers.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. And then the Egyptian stuff, right?
All the artwork in that museum, it was just, I don't know, in this a very receptive state of mind.
Wasted, you mean?
I don't know if we were smoking that much then.
So every single one of our readers will know who David Hockney is. Like, what was it about David Hockney's the show that just kind of...
The funny thing is, we'd started pissing around with landscapes a bit. For me, that was my way out. But I don't think we'd thought about it in terms
how
of like...
to do it.
There's no way we'd use that. It was just like, you know, like... Sunday painters just sitting there casually doing their amateur
because the landscape's got a certain rules
whatever just, or language
and also the associations that landscape painting has, the whole
exactly sort of it's like, oh thing. No you can't possibly, oh no, that's like the naffest fucking thing you possibly, especially for a record cover.
Let's do that
because you were doing these landscapes with like purple and some pretty,
but then so was he. That's what blew our mind. It's like,
because this show, it was a show where he had all of his paintings of the Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. And you know, Hockney is kind of an amazing artist. He's gone through
I really love his early scratchy scoop stuff.
Yeah. But these ones of the Grand Canyon, it was orange straight out of the tube. It was incredible. They were just like, whoa. And then he got, you know, then I think almost straight after that, he started doing his the beginnings of the East Yorkshire paintings that, again, were just like, wow! Just kind of like the joy that a child has with doing a picture with no expectation and no one's going to tell him it's shit. And the way that children draw, it was like that. It had that
which
fantastic energy.
For a couple of art students who are under pressure to now produce new work, it was like carte blanche, you know, you are free, you can go anywhere you like, it's okay. It was a bit like that.
Does that help or hinder the creative process? Because sometimes, like, if you're sitting there and you've got three colors that aren't the right colors, it just forces you into a creative practice that's maybe a little different. And then sometimes when you don't have any limitations, it's actually the expanse of not having something there to guide you.
Our limitation was ourselves. I mean, our biggest problem was like I said earlier, this self-annihilating...
Yeah, just sort of to think that shit.
And you guys are your own judge and jury at this point.
Yes.
It's not like the other bandmates are coming in being like, guys, you need to use some more orange here.
Not really.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
They were just...
It was really nice. The funny thing was that like the painting studio especially... if you wanted to call it that, that we shared with the rats or whatever.
Yeah. Voles and rats and just a lot of spiders.
Had a lovely little wood-burning stove in it, and like people come in just to get away from listening to the same 18 bars of music for like 4 days, you know, so they come and chill. And so the painting studio became like a refuge.
They
from...
sort of burned me like a CDR of wherever the music was, and I had like a £99 CD player.
Yeah, so that's where we go for an overview of what we were doing as well.
So, because I'd have that to sort of paint to, with, of, from.
But it was also... one of them. I'll edit that out.
Yeah, I like that. Well, I was just saying, because you do paint from the music in a way.
And with.
But you guys were exchanging imagery before these recording sessions. The faxes were coming before?
That was shit.
I don't know. No, the faxes were pre that. So the faxes were like after OK Computer. That was our main source of communication.
But that was more just communication rather than for a particular goal?
Kind of both. It just became kind of, we take the piss and do cartoons. It wasn't really particularly serious. But as well as not having rehearsed any of the music, I had no lyrics. So there was just bits of paper with writing everywhere on the floor everywhere we went. I was constantly printing stuff out or photocopying or chopping up, and that there was just a volume of paper which I would always, when we left the studio, I would just leave it on the floor and then someone would grab it, and then turns out they kept it 20 years. It was in a shoebox.
We had a hat as well. We had a top hat.
Yes, I still have the top hat.
Has had just cut up strips of lyrics in it.
I used that a lot. I still do.
we interviewed a Los Angeles artist a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about this idea of an echo chamber in the studio and like how it's healthy for him. Is when you're doing all this stuff, is that echo chamber of the sounds and the art and everything, is that, does it get a little too echoey, or do you need to like leave it for a little bit and come back, or do you like to stay in it?
It felt like we were in it for a long time, and then Tom had to carry on being in it because he had to go and perform it. But I could escape. I think we're kind of getting a bit less neurotic in a way, because the last record we went to fucking south of France. Instead of renting some crumbling, flooded, haunted pile of rubble that was once a stately home in the middle of nowhere, we went to an actual recording studio in the actual south of France with sunshine and blue sky.
That's it.
Oh my God. Yeah. It was right by the place where Van Gogh had to go after he cut his ear off. He went there to a sanatorium to recover.
Do you feel that environment then alongside the music impacts how you're creating?
Well, I don't know. It was still a kind of period of...
You needed a lot of space, didn't you? Because you need a lot of space to do what you were doing because you were dipping, basically.
Yeah, making a lot of ponds.
Does it make a difference for you then if you're doing something in a sort of physical way or a digital way? Actually, this is a question for both of you.
Then the one after that for my record, Anima, that was like... Because we were using tracing paper and soft pencils. Yeah. So total geeky opposite sort of, that's what felt right at the time.
Yeah, scale has varied and the way to do things. It depends on, you know, for me, what I can deduce what the music's doing, what the record's doing.
Echo chamber... I mean, we bounce ideas off each other all the time, but the funny thing is they're not necessarily related to what we're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or at least they don't seem to be. For me now, the thing I miss is that we don't spend enough time together because we've been busy with this electromagnetic kid amnesia thing for so long. It's been deeply distracting.
It's nearly finished.
We've got these ideas for what we want to do with a Smile record, which I'm really, really excited about.
Yeah, we could actually do something new instead of looking at stuff from years ago.
All we've done is talk so far because it's impossible to clear our heads for it. And but we always come to something with a series of like pointers, ideas, places to start. Like when you're talking about gouache, I'm like, gouache? Yeah. All right. Fucking love the stuff.
Yeah, it's really nice. We've never painted with it before, but it's just like, whoa, this is like...
Why would I use anything else?
What about, like, do you... Because like, our readers will love this. Like, do you go to art exhibitions a lot and kind of take things in?
I mean, the last couple of years...
Well, obviously you can't at the moment. There's a lot of Instagram scrolling, but...
But I went to see a show that I was in, a part of a group show down in the New Forest. And it was called The Art of the Unsettling.
This was the landscapes.
That's right, yes. Yeah. So late Edward Burrough landscapes. I had no idea that Edward Burrough did landscapes, that he had a late landscape painting career. And there was loads of stuff. There was Paul Nash photographs, but it was more how it was curated, how it was put together. There was loads of artists I hadn't seen, but I was in there just like, whoa, I'm going to try that, and I'm going to nick that, and I'm going to steal that, and because that's what I've missed, is
being able to figure out where those other influencers are coming from.
We're both very similar in the sense that I do the same in music as well, and nowadays I watch my son doing it, and I watch my daughter doing it with film, you know, like that thing where if you watch something or you look at something and you have an emotional reaction to it, and then straight after he's like, okay, how do they do it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How do they get to that point?
How can I?
And the conversations revolve around, okay, so literally standing in front of a painting going, okay, but how did he, I mean, did we go around that Anselm Kiefer together?
Yeah.
And that was just like, okay, I give up.
Yeah.
What's the fucking point?
There was a big show in the RA I don't know, a couple of years ago, and it was just like, he's kind of like a hero.
Yeah.
Totally. I can see that's what we want.
You've previously mentioned about music being like mathematics. That it's a series of elements that will make you feel that thing. Do you feel that that visual arts is the same structure as what you would call mathematics?
It's slightly different with music because music evolves over time. everything's a division of time. Whereas with art, you're working with a still moment in theory. Does that make sense? Yeah. It sort of makes sense. No matter what you do with music, you're working with patterns. It doesn't matter what you do, doesn't matter how it's a pattern of some description, whether it's even just sound waves that are bouncing against each other, they form a pattern as they do that. Whereas with art, it's a different part of you. Sometimes to me, like the emotion, an emotional response to a piece of art is like being shown something you wanted to see for the first time. It's like something you hoped you'd see, and then eventually someone's done it. So I have the same thing with music, though. Like if I listen to a piece of music, it's like, thank God, someone's finally done that, because that needed to be done. And that sounds nuts. Does that sound nuts?
Well, it totally makes sense.
It's almost like it's in the ether and somehow it appears and it's like, okay, all right, yeah.
Yeah, but that doesn't happen that often necessarily.
So then the kind of the follow-up for that is, when does something, especially let's say, for example, Kid A, when do you see that cover art as being complete? When the pieces of the puzzle fit together?
Yeah, it's really sudden. I think it's because it almost feels like geological. For a long time, it's just you're kind of layering things and taking things away, putting them back, removing them. But there's a point where everything just is just like, oh, wow, we've got it. And it happened. It's happened with almost everything that I've done. There's a kind of long period of awfulness followed by a kind of moment of revelation, a sort of epiphany. It's like, oh, that's the way. And with the Kid A landscapes, there was a point where the intersection of digitally created imagery intersected with collaged and painted and photographed work was just, it just went, and we're like, that's it, we've got it. And then we could keep doing that. Once you've figured it out, you've got a way to work, and you've got limited time.
Weird frustration as well, because like, well, frustration is not maybe quite the right word, but like me, I could sort of fucking see it in my head. It was like, it could be like that, it could be like that, but there was no way of getting there directly. It would, if you sat there and describe it, you can only say to yourself, oh, I saw that when it actually came. So when we got the cover, I think I realized that's something like a vision I'd already had in my head, and that really freaked me out, because yeah, like I'd already seen it or something really like it. And the same with when we first started layering these stills that we'd taken from Lightwave on top of landscapes with similar shapes. So yeah, something purely digital, very crunchy, yeah, on top of something soft and disturbed.
I'd seen all these expressionist prints when we were in Copenhagen, which featured really, really exaggeratedly pointed, I think they were trees, representations of trees, black points. And then we were doing that with the mountains. But the thing that was really key to creating that artwork was the fact we could make these huge paintings, photograph the painting, and then scan that, and then we could use this program that was called Lightwave. I don't know if it still exists or if it's been
changed.
Yeah, but early days we didn't know what we were doing. But with Nigel, Nigel Godrich, producer, we were all sort of sitting around the computer, and he'd figured out this thing. We could put a flat image, a scanned image, into this program, and by making it black and white, we make it into a bump map. And then we could layer the coloured version of the same picture on top of this actual terrain.
So set you up create this fragmented terrain that you could,
amazing.
You could then move
fly
it
through it, and then take screen grabs as
that blew our tits off completely.
You flew through a landscape you just made with a painting,
yeah,
as if you were in an aeroplane. It was fucking incredible.
Yeah.
So we were just going.
So the question is, though,
whatever it is, you take a screen grab with, and then going through these massive folders of screen grabs we had of this world that didn't exist, but it sort of did, and we've made it.
The question is, I don't think we always end up doing it like that, though. I mean, I'm looking at the anima stuff that's on the wall over there, And what all we had with Anima was a typewritten list of scenarios.
Yeah.
What the fuck that
came
from?
But we listened to the music. We were sitting there, me, you and Nigel, in your studio. And it was just every little idea that came out of the music. It was not like lyrics, but everything, anything. What does that make you think? Write it down. And then we had all these bizarre scenarios. So that
monkeys in parliament, spaceman walking out of a forest.
Spaceman. Yeah, just weird. A really long list of surreal.
And to me, it was like, yeah, that's it. We've already got it. We just got to illustrate that.
Just turn that into a drawing, please.
Yeah. Okay. So we just did it. You know, we just
as best we could.
Is this just like stream of conscious making?
Yeah.
Don't know.
So you know, and this thing that we kind of got to have a little holiday of brain rest, but then quite soon, like in November, beginning of November, we can start doing this new thing, which we've kind of looked at lots of things that could
be. Well, we've done a lot of research. Yeah.
Yeah. But we've just got to do it. And I kind of want to just go really fast and just make loads of work really fast and just, and not really care about it. As if, you know, kind of like, a kid who's just finally got out of Borstal or something, and you can do what you want again.
I keep going back to this, the fact that you guys went to art school and maybe didn't really have some major expectation of like what this had to be, and like all this experimentation kind of was almost because you didn't go in, maybe it's the era, you didn't go in thinking like I'm gonna be, you know, David Hockney.
I've basically always hidden behind him. Okay. Like, yeah. I'm like, luckily I've got a day
funny
job.
Funny he should say
but
that.
You don't do like Sunday wait, do you do Sunday painting?
Yeah, that's why we called ourselves the Sunday painters. Yeah. But if you turn it on its head, you know the sort of people who think they're musicians but not? Right. That's me, but an artist. You know, fucking hate people who think they're musicians when they're not.
You guys both kind of like, when you guys met each other in art school, were like, I'm gonna be this and I'm gonna be this. You had the music stuff already germinating, obviously.
Yeah, I went to art school because I mean I was like it was a strong look.
That was it. Well, and that is our interview here today.
This digitally driven mixed media approach to the albums took a new direction in 2006 with the release of Tom's debut solo record, The Eraser. A lone dark figure stands amidst a black and white linograph flood with an outstretched hand as if to command the water. This is the image that greets you when you arrive at the XL offices in London. After the release of the record, UK-based artist Insa continued this visual direction by creating an apocalyptic hand-painted animated GIF mural on the LA offices.
Which was the hardest album to create artwork for?
Personally, the one I worried about the most, the one I panicked about the most was The Eraser. Even though, like, that's maybe my favorite. Like, at the time, it was such a jump. I mean, when we were at art school, he did this woodcut stuff that I really, really loved. And I'd always, not woodcut, liner cut, but I'd always been banging onto him. It's like, well, come on, let's bring that into it somehow. And then when you got obsessed about, what was it, the Nuremberg Chronicles. Mm. But anyway, that's the one I just worried about. It wasn't like...
Is that because that was you? This is the first one that wasn't hidden behind Radiohead. This was actually your first record.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, it was a sort of... It was a very different... I worried, like, does this work with the music? Are we just sticking this shit together for the sake of it?
It's funny you say that, because it's like, it also feels like one of the more enduring aesthetics of kind of the stuff you guys have done together. Maybe because there's a mural on the side of the, you know, maybe there's that. But there was like, I feel like the imagery, isn't there a mural still in Los Angeles on the side of Subliminal that is
there
that?
Probably, you know, is. Yeah.
I mean, I think like...
I've seen references to it a lot in other places too.
Right. I feel like there's something about, it's interesting you said that, because I was thinking like, if he says that, it seems, I kind of, identify a lot of the work with that era.
And that wasn't, yeah. It wasn't intended to be, I was working on that at the same time. We were trying to make, I wanted for the eraser at the beginning, I wanted to make a sort of kit that it's almost if you were a campaigner for a campaign, and the campaign's called, you know, Atoms for Peace, or I think that was the idea back in that time. And I was trying to make something like, do you know the nuclear power no thanks icon with the sun? It was like that. So I wanted to make, like, the packaging would be a sort of kit, and you'd have button badges and stickers and all this stuff, and it would have a really strong brand identity like nuclear power no thanks. But at the same time, I was working on, that was called London Views. It was going to be a show at Steve Lazaridi's gallery back in the day before lots of things happened. So I was working on it at the same time, and it just sort of like became that. And it was just, you know, because I think can you stand there?
But the flooding thing was like that literally happened.
Yeah, because I was at Tom's place in Cornwall, and there was this catastrophic flood. Nobody died because it happened in the daytime.
The whole of the middle of the village.
Yeah, and I had this copy of the illustrations, the woodcuts of the Nuremberg Chronicle, and it had all these kind of op art waves. So, and it was obviously made a big impression because we had to evacuate his house and go up to higher land and just sort of watch this and listen to this noise. The noise a flood makes is like you've never had anything like it.
When you see water in that scale moving like that, was like, you know, it was right in the middle of making the record, and it informed so much of the lyrics, and it also informed this obsession with the idea of water movement. Yeah. When you actually see it pulling shit away. So what was so beautiful was the fact that it was like the synthesis of, like, you were getting obsessed about the Nuremberg Chronicles anyway.
Yeah.
It was like, okay, so if it was, how would you represent that? Represent it in a super crude way, you know, and it really worked for that. So all these things sort of, how much was that related to the music? It wasn't necessarily related in the sense of, like, there was synesthesia.
Yeah.
It was more like a weird, fucked up narrative. And then at the end, the guy we put on the end, it was like, we needed an end, remember? And I was like, Canute. What about if it's just
Canute? The guy, King Canute. There's you probably know, I don't know if it's gone across the Atlantic, but it's this king. It was one of the last Viking kings of England. And he was, his courtiers said, you are like a god, you can do anything. And he kind of proved that he was human by saying, okay, I can turn back the tide then.
When you first, like, witnessed these huge tides when they come in, like, you know, this force of nature like that, with these insane waves, with friends of mine surfing them. And I used to sort of always have this image. I think I even did it as a game with Noah, my son, when he was really small, where you'd stand there with your hand like that, going, "Come on, don't come on, you're not going to wash me away," you know, that sort of weird idea.
I forget that you, in a way, this work gets associated with that Laz era, that particular era of kind of...
Essex moment.
An era with a complicated past.
Yeah.
And sometimes even more complicated.
The Britpop of art.
Yeah, exactly. Good, I'll let you have that moment. a fruitful era of people getting themselves educated about what was happening in the art world through a different avenue. Yeah. And the way that you guys have done artwork for many years is, there's probably lots of people who learned about other art or started thinking about art in a different way. I think there is something kind of interesting that there is an association with that kind of era, because that was kind of the starting point for a lot of people. That was even when Juxtapose took off into, like, a different direction as well, bigger direction, really.
There was no way that, I don't know really personally, but I know that you couldn't see yourself in the mainstream. No. You couldn't.
The look of disgust that's just taken his face there.
It was difficult to imagine, you know, some sort of gallery pitching the work as they would pitch other artists who'd been hosted at the Saatchi or whatever. Yeah. It was like, nah, that's not going to happen.
Right.
And not least which, because there's an inherent snobbery. And it's like, well, if we've done cover art, clearly we're not artists.
Yes. Right.
Because it's commercial.
Yeah.
With what Banksy did, I think that was, it was a lot of hard work to get to that point. And it kind of took off when they did the elephant in the room in LA.
Right.
And that's what did it.
Yeah.
As well as some creative work on auction sites. But it was brilliant. And the anonymity thing is brilliant as well. Because, you know, when years ago when I was taking my kids around to see secondary schools, the amount of projects that kids doing art did on Banksy and street art was amazing. And their enthusiasm for it, incredible. Like nothing I ever saw before. And it's sort of, because it's a bit naughty as well, in those early days doing stuff with Steve, it was great, you know, just because it was just like, yeah, let's just do that. It felt very anarchic. It felt kind of like the great rock and roll swindle kind of thing. It was a little bit cartoony, and it was very cheeky, and it was naughty, and it was all the things that I wanted.
Gangster.
It was all the things I thought art should be. You know?
There was a raw energy to it that was really fun.
I really liked it, you know, and it was great. And it was, you know, because like graffiti was totally considered as vandalism before Banksy, really. You know, maybe there's some tiny exceptions, but no one really knew about it. Mm. And now, like, you know, he goes and does a painting on a wall in a depressed seaside town, and it can completely change the fortunes of that town for, you know, a year or more. You know, it's brilliant, and he's a really good guy. He does good stuff.
You guys together have had some kind of it's almost in that same vein of kind of having a comfort in the streets and poking away and playing with the narrative of how things are usually put out. You did the newspaper, the Universal Sigh, and you did the, on our last conversation, we talked about the Dream recordings for Anima.
I forgot about that. And that was wicked.
And I was wondering what drives you to do these things, because it subsequently it turns into a marketing campaign, but you've never really struck me as a collective that are driven by marketing campaigns. So I feel like it comes from another place. So what is it that drives you to do that?
Kind of amateur reading of situationism, I think.
Maybe, yeah.
These kind of interventions. Mm. It's the sort of thing I think we'd be doing anyway, whether or not there was a record to sell. But because there's a record to sell, there's a fucking budget, and we can go, okay, let's print newspapers in every major city in the Western world.
Yeah, that was really fun.
Or let's rent an office in a suburban LA or something.
Oh, like, God, yeah.
And rig it up like it was the offices of,
really bad.
Of this company, Anima Technologies.
Yeah.
And let's set up CCTV and send those guys in. Oh, yeah, man, it was great.
But we also enjoy, especially working with these guys, we enjoy bouncing off ideas and stuff. It's always, you know, but the funny thing is that, like, it can also get quite tired quite quick.
Yeah.
Like, if I see another, you know, fucking surprise record drop or whatever, you know, teaser ad or 10 second fucking thing on Instagram, it's like, okay, well,
yeah,
that's all over then.
I think we've rinsed it.
So we've got to think something else.
Yeah, and it's just something. Like, so with this, we're not doing anything. We're just going to go, here it is. No, we're not going to.
I think, you know, we were really into the KLF, let's face it.
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to.
All that
the
stuff.
The KLF, when they turned up at the Brit Awards with like Sheep and Machine Guns, it was like, all right.
Amazing. Everything,
anything's now possible.
Yeah, because that when I was working in an internet cafe, if you remember those things, we had a very early digital cyber conference, you know. Sounds so quaint now.
Cyber conference, internet cafe, simpler times.
So in those days, you could just invite people who were doing interesting things on the internet, and, you know, you'd have these weird online relationships with them, and then they'd come and see you, and you'd meet each other for the first time, And we had Bill Drummond down and Gimpo, and they showed the film of them burning £1 million, which, although is possibly one of the most boring films ever made, it's still burning £1 million, which is like, yay! You know, it's fantastic. So all of that stuff, yeah, the KLF were a huge influence on these sort of weird, it's art, you know, it's art interventions. It's how to, and it makes people think.
There's one thing to be studying at college and going, yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's another thing for it to be happening in the music business like that. That was like, yeah, wow, that's very, very cool. I mean, of course, where is that now? But, you know, it's that weird intersection where you have this interesting thing where, like, potentially, you know, you're trying to attract attention. There is a little bit of money. You can do a series. You can do something that relates somehow to the work you're doing. You know, there's a lot of potential is there. And I don't think I'm ever going to be the sort of person who like, you know, gets styled and does a series of photo shoots on Instagram for blah, blah, blah. So it's always going to be some kind of intervention.
But you guys both like had kind of sheepish smiles when you were talking about some of the stuff you had done. So you clearly like there's a lot of fun in the fact that you guys get to collaborate.
Absolutely.
And do,
but that, yeah, that's almost like that's the most fun bit, because by then we've done the work. We know what the shape of the record is. And this is like, it's almost like the little reward at the end.
Yeah, it's just taking the piss, you know, like putting the chance to put these little anima adverts saying, you have trouble with your dreams, you blah, blah, blah. Like, the idea of that, like, that's so pretty. It's such a nice idea, and it makes us laugh. And to be honest, we have a very twisted, dark sense of humour that needs to be satisfied. So there's always something.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I get a charge out of it. Like the fact we could put up adverts in the tube, and you know, you sit there on the tube and you're kind of looking up and there's kind of, and there's ones that say, are you tired? Maybe you need some iron. And it's just like, have you forgotten your dreams? You're just like, yeah, because we didn't put anything on them at all that would promote the record.
Right.
Which the label loved.
Yeah, well, they did, because they're great with that stuff.
Yeah,
this one.
Another one of Tom's longtime collaborators is the Dutch audiovisual composer Tarek Barry.
I think we'd be doing slight disservice if we didn't talk about some of the stuff that you've been doing solo on stage with the visuals with Tarek.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think it'd be really. I saw a couple of shows on tour, but one of the ones at the Greek Theater in Berkeley, California, beautiful venue. That has got to be kind of fun, because every night it's different.
Really fun. Yeah. I mean, that was a really interesting thing to develop, because it started as we'd met him. He came backstage one day in Berlin a long time ago, and he wanted to show me this stuff he developed, and it was like a 3D environment, generative 3D environment for music. But this was a long time ago, like way over 10 years ago. But the irony it was, it's like I wasn't really into the musical element of it, but the way he was creating these shapes and objects, I'm like, wow, that's really cool. Didn't think about it again until Nigel and I was Atoms for Peace, and we because Flea was busy on tour, we couldn't do that, so we started developing like a DJ thing, and we wanted to do some form of projection, and we wanted it to be part of the performance.
Was that the Oval Space? Was that the first time?
No, the first one we did was probably in New York, and we had Arca supporting us and Holly Herndon, and they just both started out. Mental. Anyway, and we spent a while with Tarek in London with this software, just fucking around, and just he's built is something really amazing, because it it's purely real time. Because I've seen enough DJ shows and whatever, even that far ago, like I don't know, 6-7 years ago, where you're like, oh, really? It's just playing. You can feel it's just playing, and it's flat, you know. Whenever you do, and I'm obsessed about the idea that there has to be some visual response, that something's really happening.
Right.
It was a weird thing. It's like painting in real time. And all I would personally be doing is like giving him feedback, sort of saying, well, maybe these shapes really work here, and sort of, again, like painting, like I'd what I do with him, like sort of saying when something works, that this really works, can we develop this or whatever? And it's really fun. And sometimes you just come with stuff that's just done and you're like, yeah, great.
And did you have to be like, okay, well, you're going to come on tour with us. It has to work this way. Like you're now the third part of this performance. And that was kind of something he was like, okay, let's.
Yeah. Well, it started off that was such a weird process, that whole thing, because it started off with, we'd all be hiding behind decks anyway. So right. It wasn't like, so there's three of us, And then suddenly we're like, oh shit, we're on stage. Someone's booked us into theater. So then I started wandering around, and then it became like, okay, now we need bigger projections. And now it's a bit like Kraftwerk, because we're all standing there with our own little tables. But it just sort of developed like that. There was no concept of that at the beginning at all, other than like, I really wanted to do something with him. He's super fun to work with. And because he's also a musician, he comes to it from a very particular point of view. But also there's like a geeky element, a geeky side of it to me, because I've never, he literally built that software for the ground up himself, taught himself code for the purpose of building this software. Who the fuck does that?
I kept wondering if you were on stage, you look, turn around and be like, that's a pretty good one.
Yeah, it's a bit like that. Yeah. In rehearsals, like, that's nice, Tarek. Not sure about that blue in that one, mate. But then he'd spend, he'd be there overnight, like working it up. But it's not like it's a finished thing. He's developing a series of code that then he can manipulate with his controllers.
Does that just feel like the future?
No, because no one else would understand what the fuck he's doing.
he's the only one.
Yeah, he's the only one who can drive that bugger.
So there you go. That was it. Evan Preakle and myself, Doug Gillen, in conversation with Stanley Donwood and Tom York. I'd be lying if I said that wasn't the most nervous I've ever been in my entire life. I just about managed to make through that entire interview without saying anything stupid. So I'm going to leave you with this little nugget of awkward that I managed to drop right at the very end of our interview. Shout out to Evan. That's my boy right there. He saved me on this one. If you did enjoy this episode, be sure to subscribe, hit us up on all the socials, share the love. We'll be back with you guys real soon. Till then, take care of yourselves and each other. Peace.
You guys have been working together for a long time, and even as the larger collective of Radiohead, what's the key to maintaining a creative working partnership like this for so long?
They fucking hated
Essex
that question.
This is good.
This is. I wish everyone could see the facial expressions on that.
It's hard, can't help you with that one.
Well, it helps that the aesthetic for everything is different every single album. So it's like it feels like everything is like a new project every single time you guys do something. So it's not like stale. We're recycling.
Yeah, but the hardest bit has been, it's been impossible for me personally as the way I'm built is I can't stand the idea of repeating myself. I'm horrified by the idea. I mean, it happens because it's, oh shit, that's my voice on the record. Never mind. Yeah, so there is an element of repetition.
The thing is, I thought I was deliberately trying to be a different person for each project, and I do think of them as projects because there's quite a lot around just the record. But when I did that book when I saw you guys last, it was because that was the first time I put it all together. I was like, it is definitely the same thing. There's something, whatever it is, I don't know what it is.
But just the desire to.
But it's to try to at least try
to jettison
reinvent
everything every time. What keeps us going, really. But that's hard to do.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.
Right. Thank you. That was really thank you so much for your time. Yeah. Appreciate that.